Hello and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And today we're delighted to have Ben Steinfeld joining us. Ben, welcome.
It's so great to be back with both of you. Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you. Now, for our listeners, you may remember Ben from one of our earliest podcasts back in 2011. We'll get to that. But for those of you who are newer to the program, Ben is a founder and co-artistic director and acting company member of Fiasco Theater. He's worked as a director and actor on Broadway and national tours and across the country at theaters such as the Westport Playhouse, Williamstown Festival, Trinity Rep, McCarter, the Old Globe, Actors Theater of Louisville, the Folger Theater, many more. He's appeared on television and is a writer, composer, and musician. He's also a faculty member at NYU, where he has twice received the Excellence in Teaching Award.
Welcome, Ben.
Wow. Thanks for that lovely intro. Thank you, guys.
It's pretty concise. It doesn't give you your full due, but it really it ends on a strong note. The Excellence in Teaching Award. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is for about 15 years or more, I guess. I've been an adjunct and professor and an artistic associate at NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study, which is a very interesting place where the students kind of create their own course of study, which they mix together from a series of interdisciplinary seminars and arts workshops that are offered within Gallatin. And then they'll sometimes also take classes at the other colleges of NYU that are based around their interests. So you get a lot of students that are kind of mixing together things that maybe you wouldn't think of as going together. You know, they'll want to study fashion and economic development. They'll want to study, you know, theater and political history. They'll want to deal with different things and try to bring them together. So the arts are of interest to a lot of different students there. So sometimes I'm dealing with students that might think of themselves as wanting to become actors or directors or sort of work professionally in the field. But a lot of times you're dealing with people who are not in that mindset. And so there's a lot of openness and a lot of ability to sort of talk about real stuff. But at least in the classes that I teach, I'm approaching it the same way I would with the MFA students that I sometimes work with, or with the professionals that I work with, which is to sort of say, what is it that actors and directors do? And how do we practice doing that well? And how do we do that in a way that gives us the most pleasure and kind of makes us want to do it again? And as you both know, there's still too much of a kind of legacy in the world of teaching, of acting, especially that somehow it's supposed to be painful or involve a lot of suffering and stuff. And it's not that change and growth isn't difficult, because we are our own instruments as actors. And so it's always hard not to feel that it's personal, because it is. But I think there's really ways to talk about that make people feel empowered and make them kind of, even when they're young, rediscover what they might have liked about this in the first place if they've had some rougher experiences along the way. And we also get a lot of students at Gallatin who transfer in from Tisch, who sort of thought they wanted to be in a conservatory and then kind of freaked out. So sometimes it's nice to help people kind of refine the thing that brought them to the table. But teaching has become a huge part of my career. And, you know, I've had some good teachers along the way, and Fiasco has worked with some great people who've helped us grow along the way. And I've developed some of my own ideas along the way, and it's become something that I really love to do, and that feels closer and closer to me to acting and directing. I really think all three of those practices are fundamentally the same.
So in your classes, you may encounter students who don't have a deep background in theater, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah. And or some other countries, and sometimes English as a second language and things like that.
What do you hope that they walk away with?
I hope they understand that acting is actually a thing, and that it's a thing that people can learn and can be practiced, and that you can actually practice the important aspects of acting as you go about your day. That acting isn't really about pretending to be someone else. It isn't really about lying. It isn't really about those kinds of things or even sort of creating a character per se, as the sort of film world, you know, kind of relentlessly pounds us with. And so then I think people kind of think, oh, I should, you know, immerse myself in a character kind of thing, which is an aspect of acting sometimes. But really it's like, you know, as my friend and Fiasco colleague Jesse Austrian says, you know, you can practice using your real voice at Starbucks when you order coffee. You know, you can practice receiving what someone else says on the breath when you talk to your parents or your partner or your friends. You know what I mean? So the real things that make a difference in how someone relates to themselves and relates to language and relates to sound and stuff like that, there is a level on which those are kind of life skills. And I personally am a little nervous at the trend that I feel I've seen a lot since I spoke with you last, in the university world, which is to sort of try to get as far away as possible from the idea that theater is a real thing or that there is such a thing as a theater career. Really, all we need to do is show how theater is a tool to do other things. So I don't try to immediately go to the ways in which studying this stuff is useful in other contexts, but it absolutely is.
100%. Ben, when we last spoke, you said something very similar that you just said, which is receive on the breath. And I found that concept very inspirational. Can you pick that apart a little bit?
Sure. I guess I haven't learned anything in the last
No.
Still sputing the same stuff. It's exactly the word you just used, actually, Jim, which is inspiration. You said you found that inspiring. So to inspire is actually the idea, right? We're actually taking breath in. So the idea is that it is on the inhale that you actually receive the inspiration for the thing that you want to say. And I think that too often in Shakespeare and in acting, we think that we're responsible for self-generating everything that happens. But usually with good writing, the thing that you receive from the person who speaks before you, or the thing that you receive from yourself, if you're in a speech, is the thing that creates the possibility of the next thing. And it's also what creates the possibility of variety and surprise and discovery. And we have all kinds of games and exercises that we use, whether in rehearsal or in the classroom, to sort of discover that sensibility of not knowing and of not needing to know. So that's kind of what it's about. It also is really relevant for voice work. We've worked with Sis Berry and Andrew Wade, and also my friend and colleague Liz Hayes, who's at Columbia now, who've given us a lot of information, ways to think about voice and text and breath. But one of the things that I think Liz helped us with during this process, and that I talk about a lot in class too, is that the relationship to the other person really has to be established on the inhale, on the breath, and not through sound. You can't go looking for the person you're trying to reach on sound if you haven't kind of already included them in the reception of the breath. So it's useful for all kinds of things. It has a huge number of technical benefits in the room and in the resonance and in the listening and all that stuff. But it's also about how you stay in relation to yourself and to someone else.
Thank you so much. I've been talking about listening too with my students recently, and how I've broken it down into three kinds of listening. And I think one of the things you said made me think of this, which is when you're speaking a monologue, you're inspiring yourself in a way. And that's one of the kinds of listening, is listening to yourself while talking. Then the other kind of listening is listening in silence. And then the third kind of listening, which everybody knows, is listening to your partner. So when you said that, it made me think about listening and how listening is not just passive listening, it's active listening.
Yeah, you're right. It is. It's always easier said than done with that, because a lot of people then feel responsible for sort of indicating their listening, which is tough, although I don't think it's as much of a crime and could just be allowed to be a part of the process. You know, let's have some embarrassing acting of listening. Who cares? What's the crime? Yeah, I mean, but like if the things that you're saying would cause you to have a response, you should have that response before telling yourself, I shouldn't pull focus from the speaker. It's like, it's important to know, we use a phrase that a clown teacher, our friend Justine Williams, uses sometimes to talk about, like, who's in major and who's in minor, right? How does that alternate over the course of a scene or of an event or of a beat? Yeah, you want to know that, and you want to be able to have some give and take there. But as part of a process, I don't think people should ever feel that they have to censor their responses just because it's not what you might end up doing in performance. And we do a fun game. I did this once with a group with the opening of King Lear, you know, the scene where Lear is dividing up his kingdom. Well, there's a lot of people there who don't say very much, but they're heavily implicated in what he's talking about. Specifically the husbands, you know, Cornwall and Albany are kind of, they have like one line each or something, but there's a lot going on for them. So anyway, we did this game where we sort of just put a random casting on the scene, and we did an exercise where anytime somebody says something, a word, a phrase, an idea that is relevant to you, you just repeat it back aloud. Not your response to it, but you let your response come through in the fact that, you know, he says something about ample third of the ample whatever. Now I'm just making things up. An ample third of this. And you just go, ample third. Right. And you let yourself do that. And it was creating all kinds of people were making all kinds of crosses and doing all kinds of fascinating things. And it was chaos. It was aural chaos. But that's what made you realize, oh, my God, every single thing that's being said here is relevant to almost every single stakeholder in this group dynamic. And so you just have to make some space for that in the process. And then, you know, it won't feel like your turn, my turn.
Mm-hmm. So now, in terms of process, you're getting Pericles up on his feet, yeah?
We are. This is something that we did as a sort of workshop production through our initiative that we started recently called Without a Net, which is a fiasco theater initiative where we take a project we're interested in, we rehearse it for about 10, 12 days, and then we start sharing it with an audience for about 10 performances. And we started it because we actually wanted to get back into the spirit that we had the sort of last time I had talked to you guys when we were first starting out, and we were more reckless and kind of brave. And as you get bigger and as you start working with partners and as you start, you know, developing a repertory of work and a body of work, it kind of starts to feel like each choice you make is kind of getting important or meaningful or something. And we just felt in the post-COVID moment when we could finally get back together, we just wanted to kind of return to Shakespeare, which A, we hadn't built a new one of in a very long time. And B, we wanted to kind of get back into that spirit we had when we first made Cymbeline, which was just a sort of rehearsal room feel of trying to tell the story is in a kind of reckless way and making big, bold choices and being kind of in that zone together. So I volunteered to direct it because I had one or two ideas about what I thought we might be able to do with it. And somewhere along the way in that process, I ended up taking on the role of Gower, who is the sort of narrator of the story as well. And I wrote some songs for it because we couldn't get the rights to an album that I thought would be cool to intersperse throughout the whole show. So I wrote some songs as kind of placeholders. And then suddenly those were the songs we were using. But it was cool. And anyway, Jill Rafson from Classic Stage Company saw that and decided she wanted to produce it as part of their season this year, which has been very cool. And they've got a wonderful sort of three-quarter thrust 200-seat space there, which suits this production very well. That was how we kind of did it the first time, except it was like 50 seats in a 50 folding chairs, but still in the sort of three-quarter setup. And it's great. It's the same cast. And so we've been able to really deepen our work this time around and engage all kinds of other stuff that we just didn't have time to get into the first time. We've restored some things that we've cut. We've reordered some things, made all kinds of new discoveries. And we run through March 23rd. And it's been really cool to see how design has become a part of the equation, and also just to really feel the maturity and depth and growth of Fiasco's acting ensemble because of what the play asks for and because of sort of where we are in our lives and stuff. I think we've been able to open up some new territory that maybe we haven't been in before, and I'm very proud of that.
So when we last spoke to you, it was 2011, and Fiasco was preparing to bring its production of Cymbeline to, I think, theater for a new audience. It was maybe the second or third iteration of that production. And at that time, we talked about your training at Brown and how Fiasco came together as a company. And at the time, Fiasco was just an up-and-coming theater company that was starting to attract a lot of attention. But a lot has happened with Fiasco since 2011. Can you catch us up?
I'll try. A lot has happened. I can give you some of the highlights, I guess. After Cymbeline, which had a lot of music in it, the idea was floated by some people that we should really consider doing a musical. So we decided to do Into the Woods, which was the most kind of ensemble-y and Shakespearean musical we could think of, with Sondheim being the most kind of Shakespearean of musical theater writers, I guess, in terms of his use of language and content and theatricality and stuff. So we ended up doing that at the McCarter, and Sondheim and Lapine were very supportive of that. They came to see it, and that show ended up having a journey that was even more improbable than Cymbeline. It went to the Old Globe, and then it played the Roundabout in New York, and you know, we won some awards and really got lots of attention for that. And then that production went to the Meunier Chocolate Factory in London, which has obviously a long relationship with doing Sondheim revivals. And that was really an extraordinary experience. And then after that, it went on a national tour with a new cast. And it played the Kennedy Center in D.C. and you know, the Palace in Cleveland and the Amundsen in L.A. and the Golden Gate in San Francisco. And we were on this kind of, it was essentially a sort of Broadway level tour. We were playing huge theaters that were also showing, you know, Hamilton and Spamalot and whatever else was on the Something Rotten, you know, whatever else was on the road at that time. So it was really unusual for a show of ours to be in those kinds of environments, but it went really well and it was well received. And it led to us wanting to do another show of Sondheim's. And so we worked on Merrily We Roll Along for a couple of years, which we actually really collaborated with Sondheim quite closely on. And we got access to a bunch of archival drafts and different things and kind of pieced together over a couple of years our own kind of Frankenstein version of all these different drafts of the show. We almost got him to write some new songs, but not quite. And but that was really an extraordinary experience to kind of be in ongoing collaboration with him. And that was at the Roundabout in 2019 and was was also really cool. And so many people from the original production, you know, that it had such a rough go on Broadway, where it came to see it and told us how much it meant to them. And people like Lonnie Price and other people who were really present at the birth and who know so much about Steve's work were so supportive, as was Sondheim himself. So it was quite something. So that was a huge arc for us, was our opportunities to collaborate with Sondheim before he died. And then we also ventured into other kinds of classical theater. We did a production of Molière's The Imaginary Invalid. We did Francis Beaumont's The Night of the Burning Pestle last year, which is, to say it's rarely produced would be an understatement, but we sort of expanded into other kinds of classical stuff. And we've also started developing new plays. Two of our company members, Noah Brody and Paul Coffey, have been commissioned to create an adaptation of a short story that maybe I shouldn't name, just in case there's anything private there. But that's going to happen, we think, in the coming seasons. We've developed a new musical of mine that I wrote with Alex Gemignani called Diamond Alice, and we've worked with Aditi Brennan Kapil on her play Imogen Says Nothing through Our Without Net Initiative and stuff. So we've also started dealing with new work and stuff that's bubbling up from us and other writers that we're excited about. And perhaps most importantly, we've added three new company members, Paco Tolson, Tina Chillip, and Devin E. Hawk, two of whom are in Pericles. And so that happened a few years ago and has also sort of deepened and expanded the scope of what the ensemble itself can be. So I'm sure I missed some things, but those are some of the highlights.
Well, the time that Fiasco made such an impression with the production of Cymbeline, it was surprising and exciting because in part, Cymbeline was one of Shakespeare's less loved and maybe often looked plays. I'm sure Night of the Burning Pestle is another example of an obscure play that you brought to light. But I think it's fair to say the same about Pericles, which is your current production. So what is it that excited you creatively about Pericles?
Yeah, a few things. I don't think it's an accident that the thing that brought us back to wanting to discover that kind of sensibility we had with Cymbeline the first time around was to revisit another one of Shakespeare's late romances. So Cymbeline and Pericles and The Winter's Tale and The Tempest are that sort of quartet of late plays from Shakespeare that are sort of grouped together, and they have certain qualities that nothing else has. And that's what drew me to Pericles, was that the late plays are so varied and eclectic, and they always involve some kind of dealing with time in ways that are really radical and interesting, and tone and place and character. They have magic, they have music. They encounter evil in a kind of different and deeper way than the comedies do, but they still sort of end up bringing together a kind of climactic act five of resolution that feels more like the way comedies tend to resolve and stuff. And in the case of Pericles, it's so episodic in a way that I can't think of a single Shakespeare play that works that way, where massively important characters show up and then just disappear. And I was intrigued by the idea of how we might do an ensemble production of a play that has such a strong central character who has so much stage time. And so I had this idea that since Pericles is really written as a kind of everyman, you know, his language isn't super specific. He's not like a lot of the other Shakespearean protagonists in that things kind of keep happening to him. He's all kinds of interesting responses to that, but he's not necessarily in charge of making those things happen. But he does have a lot of fascinating responses and reactions and improvisations and choices as a result of what happens to him. But anyway, I thought it was kind of somewhat unspecific, and I thought maybe that would lend itself to multiple people playing the role. And I had that idea for a couple of reasons. One, as I said, because we're an ensemble company, I wanted everyone to, you know, kind of be in the middle of the story somehow. But the other was that I thought it would be important, especially in the moment that we're in now, that the production would be able to say all different kinds of people can stand in for the universal. So that it's important that Pericles appears to be a person of many identities. Gender identities and racial identities and body types and things like that, so that we can be sort of saying, look, if we're going to do a story that's about displacement, that's about resilience, that's about hope, that's about virtue, and that's about, you know, kind of endurance and being a stranger in a strange land, you know, that's a story that is globally sort of true for all kinds of people right now, and we should be representing that in as many ways as possible. So at first I thought, oh, well, wouldn't it be cool if all nine of us played Pericles? And I did a kind of drafted up this sort of schematic with the sound. I was like, oh my God, Pericles basically has about nine scenes, and look how we're going to do this whole thing. Anyway, we tried reading it, and it completely fell apart. I made no, but people were intrigued by the idea, and we ended up kind of landing on the idea that we would rotate the actor playing Pericles at some major moment of inflection in Pericles's life, which is sometimes brought about by a sort of natural disaster, a sort of storm or a shipwreck. Other times is brought about by the changes that we all understand from our lives, like becoming a parent or experiencing the death of someone that you love. And so that's how we built it. And it ended up lining up essentially with the breaks between Shakespeare's five acts. And so we ended up with four actors playing Pericles, who essentially is not in Shakespeare's Act Four when Marina suddenly comes into major and becomes the kind of protagonist for a while. And we had to build a vocabulary to make that make sense. And I adapted Gower's opening monologue into a song that helps set up that conceptual proposal and the why of that, building off of Gower's opening lines to sing a song that old was sung. So we're sort of acknowledging that we're telling this old story, and that even though people now are more sophisticated, that maybe if you listen closely, it might bring you pleasure and wake you up and soothe your soul. And then I go on to it, and then I wrote some stuff that goes on to explain that, well, essentially I say Pericles was prince of Tyre, and to honor's grace he did aspire, but life did send him endless trials as he sailed the seas for countless miles. And with each test or twist of fate, he became a different person straight. Each scene, each change, each phase of life, reborn he was from every strife. And so that's really what the show is about, is kind of rebirth, different kinds of death and different kinds of rebirth, or the illusion of death or the illusion of living. And so by God, it kind of works. That's just one of the organizing principles of the production, but it is the sort of big idea of the show. And it means that people who play Pericles are playing other characters in other scenes. And then we've got, you know, four people doing that, and then four people doing all the other characters who Pericles has to kind of regularly interact with, you know, Marina and Thaisa and Helicanus and Simonides and things like that. It plays really well, and it lets the company shine, and it lets people kind of swell and grow into their strengths. And I think it makes the character more interesting, right? Not something we've ever tried before.
Sounds fascinating. And I've always looked at Pericles as a Shakespearean miniseries, which makes that choice make sense, because in, you know, like if you look at The Crown, there's many different people playing Diana, and yeah. Pericles does play with time, and it spans a long period of time. So I think that's a really fascinating take on it, and I'm really excited to see it, and everybody should go see it.
Yeah, I hope you will come if you can. And the other thing that turned out to be true in my kind of reading of the play is, as you say, it's a miniseries, and part of what that means to me is that each of Shakespeare's acts is actually kind of functioning within its own mini genre. You know, the romance itself is not just eclectic, but that means within it you can have stuff that's actually kind of playing by its own rules for a while and then changing. So for example, for me, Act One is really sort of a political thriller. But then Act Two becomes a kind of musical romance, a kind of love story. And then Act Three becomes this kind of epic melodrama. And then suddenly in Act Four, you have a young, you know, sort of almost orphaned protagonist in the kind of world of those 19th century, what do they call them? Buildings Romans, you know, those kind of coming of age stories where you have a kind of young innocent whose goodness stands in stark opposition to the adults that surround them who are trying to kind of destroy that. But they sort of triumph. And then Act Five brings together the miracle play, which is a sort of passion play tradition from the Middle Ages, in which a character has kind of gone through all sorts of trials, but sort of virtue redeems them in the end and kind of reunites them and stuff. And I think the other reason that the late plays like Cymbeline and Pericles and stuff are so powerful for the audience and for us at this time in our lives is that, you know, the comedies are always about the bringing together of two lovers. And the late plays are about the restoration of a family. That's who's trying to find each other, is parents and children. And sometimes partners too. You know, Thaisa returning in Pericles and Hermione returning in The Winter's Tale, things like that. But they have love stories within them, which makes them wonderful and great in those moments. But it's ultimately about parents and children kind of coming back together. And there's something about that I think is just different for audiences. Has a kind of richness that you kind of can't believe what's happening to you as you experience it, because it shouldn't be possible, but then it is.
You mentioned song, and music and song is such an integral part of Fiasco Theater. You know, you mentioned that you, as a theater company, decided that you wanted to dabble in musical theater. And so your first foray was simply to do a Sondheim show that would be beautifully well received and travel the world. You yourself are a songwriter, composer, musician. What's your training in music?
Garrett, I did not have that much to do in high school, so I had some time to learn the guitar, I guess. No, I mean, my family is pretty musical, but that all of that has been in the sort of folky 1960s, folky New York kind of world for the most part. I've got cousins and aunts and uncles and stuff who are really into classical music and had a lot more sort of specific training than I did, certainly. But I just did some guitar work and some piano work, and I got into theater through singing and through music. As you well know, Garrett, if you're a boy in high school who can sing, they will get you into the show and into this musical
I don't know
somehow.
anything about
Indeed.
that.
So, that was, and I ended up going to performing arts camp and stuff like that. But anyway, I just kept being around people who like to make music, and my songwriting skill is really limited to my own sort of knowledge of my limits as a guitar player and as a pianist and stuff like that. So the music that I'm writing is pretty simple. But I do think that for some reason, in the context of Fiasco's productions, it's found a kind of home. But this time around, I felt really supported by the company in sort of stepping forward more to kind of put my musical point of view out there. Whereas in the past, I've done more kind of like of a mix of like curating public domain things and folk songs and a cappella songs and work songs and Renaissance motets. And that's part of the fun for me too, is kind of the curation and adaptation. But this time around, it's really almost all original stuff. And again, they're brief and they serve the story, I hope. But I do think they expand the audience's listening as well. I think it's the kind of music and the kind of songwriting that invites the kind of tune up for the audience's ears that's gonna be necessary to receive 2 hours of Shakespeare.
That's
So
that feels very clear. It doesn't feel as if the musical elements that I've seen in the shows come off as being, and also there's music, or here's something to set a mood, but more like they're intrinsically part of the narrative structure. You mentioned lyrically that you created a song for Pericles that serves that function, but musically as well, are there places in Pericles where the music is essential to the narrative?
Only at the end, actually, I think. Maybe I'd have to go back and look, but we actually have, I mean, sometimes we're musicalizing songs that the play says happen. But in the case of Pericles, as I said, I took a Gower speech and sort of adapted the beginning of that into a song that I then added other sections to, so that it did the three things that I felt the opening of the play had to do. It had to say, here's the story of Pericles, and here's why you should pay attention to it. Here's the way this production is going to portray Pericles, and here's why. And then finally, we don't have anything reasonable to represent the depth and breadth of this story, so your imaginations are going to have to get on board, which is what any good chorus in a Shakespeare play asks for. But really, I think this play, Pericles and Henry V, are the only ones who have the kind of chorus showing up quite this much. So Shakespeare kind of knows that the audience needs a guide here in order to help set things up. So that's one thing. And then I added a song in the Pentapolis sequence because, they have this big feast and there's some dancing, which is wonderful. Our movement consultant, Tavon Gamble, put together some wonderful dance sequences for us when Pericles and Thaisa are dancing and falling in love and stuff. But then they all go to bed, and then like the next morning, the king is like, "Hey, Pericles, thanks for that great music last night. You're so great." But the play never says what that was or is. So I decided to write a song for Pericles and Thaisa to sing in that kind of classic musical theater mode, where they can be in separate spaces but having the same kind of wish for each other. Not a full-on conditional ballad, but that same kind of proposal. So again, it gives the audience a chance to see what they're actually feeling for each other, rather than just saying that it happened off stage. So that's a sort of, I guess, an offstage event that I put on stage. And then I wrote a song for Marina at the top of Act Four, because I thought it would be cool for the audience to have a chance to kind of connect to her immediately through that mode, because we don't have a lot of time to get to know her point of view. And again, I adapted like a 6-line, 8-line speech that she has, and I took the first few lines of that, and then that became the beginning idea, and then expanded it. And then at the end of the play is the only time where music is really called for. Marina kind of sings a song to Pericles, which is just a way of kind of trying to get him to start coming back to life. And then that leads to the whole recognition scene. But then he starts to hear the music of the spheres, which kind of causes him to become drowsy and fall asleep. And that's when he has a dream in which the goddess Diana says, "You need to go to my temple." So again, that's a speech in Shakespeare's play. At first, I had it as text, and then I think it was Jesse Austrian who said, "We really should have a musical event for Diana that's much bigger than this, and I think it should be a cool a cappella event or something. So then I went off and wrote a little piece for us that again took Diana's speech and adapted it and made it into kind of lyrical sense that the audience could process. But we actually do something very interesting in our production in Act Five, which is that usually Pericles hears this music and everyone else on stage goes, "What are you talking about? We don't hear it." And then he falls asleep and the underscoring continues into Diana, right? So we decided to run the risk of doing the opposite, which is that he keeps saying, "Listen to that music," and it's silent. And so the audience is kind of giggling along with the people on stage going, "I don't hear anything, my lord," because there's nothing. So first we're kind of with their experience. And then when he falls asleep, the music comes in and we sort of get his experience. And so I think that's a kind of interesting place where we're actually removing music from a place where normally it would be there. Again, those are the kind of risks I feel like, you know, we can take within our context.
I really want to see this production. So this would normally be the place where we segue into the piece of Shakespeare text.
Sure.
That you'd like to share with us. And you're surprising us.
Well, I wanted to share like a 5-line exchange between Marina and Pericles in the recognition scene in Act 5, Scene 1, because I wanted to sort of be more transparent about how it works when you work on Shakespeare, which is that you discover things on opening night or whatever, or closing performance that you can't believe you didn't see and hear before, because it's just too much to get it all. And something happened in rehearsal yesterday that, you know, we were almost breakdancing in the streets when we realized it, because it was so wild to us. So when Pericles first sees Marina, he says to her, he says, "Pray you, turn your eyes upon me," because she's not facing him. And he sees her and he goes, "Oh my God, you're like, you look just like my," you know, he almost says wife, right? And he says simply, "What countrywoman? Here of these shores?" And her response is, "No, nor of any shores. Yet I was mortally brought forth and am no other than I appear." Why does she say that? She says that because she was born on a boat in the middle of the ocean. So she can't say she's from anywhere. But she was born of woman. She was mortally brought forth. And then Pericles says right after that, she says, "Yet I was mortally brought forth and am no other than I appear." And Pericles says, "I am great with woe and shall deliver weeping. My dearest wife was like this maid, and such a one my daughter might have been." And then he goes on about how seeing her is so overwhelming for him, and that he's so sad that he's gonna cry while he talks about this. Okay. I was trying to figure out why I couldn't quite stay with the actor playing Pericles for this moment. I thought maybe he's stretching the text too much, or he's too worried about having to represent this emotional state that he's describing. And I, working backwards, I said, "You know, this is funny. It's great with woe." I said, "Usually we refer to somebody as being like great with child, like, you know, the belly has swelled with pregnancy." And then he went, "Yeah, oh God." And then I say, "And I will deliver weeping." And then we went, "Oh my God, she just told you how she was born, but that she was brought forth mortally. And then in order to encompass the way that you're going to talk about your emotional state, you say, 'Oh, really? Well, I'm pregnant too. And when I give birth, it will involve some tears, okay? Because you look like my wife who died in childbirth.'" I mean, that's the kind of revelation that you just sort of wish for, you know? And anyway, it blew our minds because we realized, oh, he's not starting a new beat. He's not like going inside himself and then trying to explain something that's disconnected from her answer. He's actually using her metaphor and receiving it. And of course, these are all kinds of shared lines and midline endings in this exchange. So there's really no break between their passing of this imagery back and forth. And we've got actors who can understand and deal with and embrace and embody this kind of discovery and have it change the entire thrust of everything that comes next.
It's an instance where Shakespeare is being intentional about the language, but it escapes the artist until the moment that it doesn't.
Until the moment that it doesn't, because we've got a lot of other things to think about. And what, you know, we sometimes in the room will sort of joke, or in class will sometimes joke and say, you know, Shakespeare wins again or something. That it's like, of course we've made this into a mountain that we don't know how to climb, when in fact there's like a very easy open door that's being offered here, which we could just walk right through if we weren't creating so much mishigas around the how and the why and the stuff that you know we all have to navigate and deal with. But that's, you know, to me, that's the enriching part of working on this. That's why it can sustain you over time. And that's why, you know, if we got to do Pericles again, I'm sure we'd wake up to something else that we cannot believe we didn't see or hear the first time.
Well, I'm sure you've had multiple instances of what you just mentioned where you say something seems impossible and then you realize that Shakespeare's has offered you an open door. And these problem plays are probably the place where that happens most often, I assume, where you think on first read that this situation is impossible, this narrative structure isn't going to work, this is too much of a leap for the audience to be able to follow. And then you have the realization that, no, if only we approach it in this way, which is probably the way that it was intended, it will work.
Yeah, sometimes I think that's really true. I would also just say, Garrett, I think it goes the other way, which is that there's also an assumption that these plays that are not problematic all work in exactly the same way or make all kinds of sense or something. So if you're looking at Midsummer Night's Dream or Twelfth Night or Hamlet or whatever you think of as a play that's kind of done often and is considered to have kind of unassailable dramaturgical structure or execution or something like that, when you get in there and look at those plays, you go, why does everybody do it this way? That's not what's going on here at all. And so it actually goes, I think it goes both ways. It's sort of a two-way street in terms of, by the way, I think this is really entirely, and I collaborate with scholars and academics and Shakespeare all the time, and I love them because we're all on the same team in terms of trying to make it, bring this stuff into the world in a way that matters for young people and for audiences and stuff like that. But I think too much of the legacy of what does and doesn't make sense has been dictated by academics.
Does it make you feel like a grumpy old man to have those?
No, because it's actually really important to just be able to say, like, you know, I mean, look, we worked on a Sondheim show that everybody thought could only be a certain thing, and then we revealed it to be something else. And then we worked on another, you know, with Into the Woods, everybody always thought act one is great and act two doesn't make any sense, you know, and then we completely changed people's minds about that because we had a totally different response to it as artists. We went in with, we didn't have assumptions. We knew what we didn't want to do, but we discovered something that turned us on and made sense. And then suddenly people are rehearing what was always there, but the interpretive, and that's a show from 1987, not 1607. So it doesn't take long for stuff to accumulate a whole bunch of baggage and assumptions about what it is and isn't. And, you know, we did the kind of the same thing with Merrily We Roll Along. And it doesn't mean that everyone will agree with you. It doesn't mean that, you know, people will do that. But I, you know, we've been through this with a sort of modern classics of musical, two musicals from the 1980s, where people think, you know, one of these is good and one of them just doesn't work. Or one of these is this and it's this. And it's just an attempt to kind of name and describe and limit and generalize and compartmentalize. And I think I'm really, as I age into middle age as an artist, I'm just becoming really wary of my own desires to do that and really resistant to other people's desires to do that. And to just say, you know what? We do not know. We do not know until we get in there. And the only way in which genre should be helpful to us is if it liberates us to be free and to not, and to try to find out what that genre invites as an opportunity, not what its limitations and assumptions are.
I think there's this thread between what you just said and the beginning of our interview where you're talking about teaching and how you approach teaching and how a student should approach a class with that idea of open mind, no assumptions, Zen mind, beginner's mind, as I like to say.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean, and the important part about that is, as you say, is that, like, that's the mindset, but it doesn't mean there's no such thing as knowing what you're doing or knowing how to ask the right questions, right? We're not investing in a technique based on luck or randomness. That's actually not what this is about at all. It's actually about making sure that the mode of investigation will actually yield something. And that's what the technique should be, is, you know, what are the questions you can ask? What are the things you can try? Understanding the difference between preparation and rehearsal? How does all of that put us in a position to make these kinds of discoveries? And then that's the kind of thing that I try to model in real time with my students, is if I am realizing something I've never heard before, I don't pretend that I always knew that was there. I'm with them going like, whoa, what? Wait a second. You know, I've heard that speech for 15 years and I've never noticed that, you know? So I think it's very important to model the real timeness with which even those of us who have a lot of experience still are able to kind of learn and discover and hear new things.
That's a beautiful place to leave it, but I won't.
You're doing a me, you're pulling a me.
I am. Because you have some very intriguing projects coming up. You've got a new musical, Diamond Alice, that you mentioned, for which you're writing the book. Is this your first book musical?
Yeah, I mean, it's been around for so long that I started working on it, I guess, in 2015, that it had, it, but it was when it began, it was the first time I had tried to write an original show, yes. And I did it on a whim because NYU, I knew my colleague who usually directed a show in the fall at NYU was going to be on leave. I was asked to direct something, and I thought, what's something that would push me into some new territory and be really fun for the students, but I really wanted to do something I hadn't done before. And around the same time, I was set up on a kind of artistic blind date with Alex Gemignani, the great Broadway actor and singer and composer and now music director, who's music directed a bunch of stuff, including the recent Sondheim musical Here We Are, and also the Ivo van Hove West Side Story and our production of Merrily. But anyway, back then we were just getting to know each other, but we really hit it off. And I knew how busy he was and stuff, and I was sort of worried that we wouldn't get to do anything if I didn't lock him down. So at that first time we met, I said, would you like to write a musical together? And I can guarantee you that NYU will do it. And he said, yeah, okay. So I became the book writer because I knew he had the compositional skill and to write this thing. So anyway, we did it first with some students, and it's developed all kinds of ways. And we've done it with professionals now, and it's now finished. And it's been through a million drafts, and I've learned so much about structure and about writing. And it's been a huge education for me. And it's about a group of women in London in the 1920s who are in an all-female shoplifting gang. And it's a sort of musical comedy. It's a farce. It's about friendship. And it's really great. And it's directed by Amanda Daynard, who's kind of a genius, as you know, Garrett. And so it's been really wonderful to work on. And then I've also got a children's musical, which is adapted from a children's book called 12 Kinds of Ice, which is a very much more intimate two-person show about childhood and winter time. But I've really gotten more interested in writing, and maybe someday these shows will see the light of day somewhere. It'd be fun.
Ben, it's great to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to you guys. It does not feel like it's been as long as it has been, and I'm really delighted to be back with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And thank you for listening to The State of Shakespeare. So glad you brought up Amanda.
Yeah.
We got to talk to her not too long ago.
Yeah, last
oh, really?
Year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tried to mention all kinds of collaborators in the interview because I just want people to know about all these people.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.